Welcome to Derps Talk About Games. I'm your co-host, Mango.
And I am your co-host, Buddy.
And today we're going to talk a little bit about designing your own campaign setting. Before we do that, Buddy, why don't you tell the folks at home what it is we do on this podcast?
On this podcast, we like to talk about games. So, I guess we should, I can do the introduction. Basically, here's the story. Here's what happened. I was in a Discord server with people who I like very much, and they were basically talking about the DM problem, which is that apparently everybody wants to play in tabletop RPG games. Nobody ever wants to run them, which I found very strange. I love running tabletop RPG games, right? So I was like, oh, is that a real issue? I'll theoretically run something for you guys. And on the spot, I kind of came up with sort of, I didn't quite come up with these, but I sort of pitched three kind of micro campaigns, right? The idea is it's a 6-session sort of story. It's a little mini campaign. I'd be happy to run it kind of thing. I pitched 7th Expedition, which you did a campaign pitch me on. I pitched Kovalgrad, which is the version of Stalingrad that is a campaign pitch me we did. And then I pitched a third one that's just, you know, 7 Samurai, but against bandits instead, but against paladins instead of bandits, right? You would maybe like that one, because the idea is that at a toll station in the mountains, a group of paladins are oppressively stealing kind of taxes from people who don't want to pay them. So it's maybe the most libertarian campaign I have ever come up with. So I pitched these three, and people got really into it. And I basically said, okay, well, listen, I'm gonna need some time to sort of like set this up. Let me get to work.
Lou says taxation is theft in the chat.
Yeah, I said, so let me get to work on it. So what I did was I went back to an old campaign setting of mine called Saran, and I began editing, because that was a campaign setting I used for 4th edition, and I began editing that campaign setting in order to sort of update it for 5th edition, and also just change some stuff, right? The old version of Saran was, I was kind of fascinated like 10 years ago with this idea of like fantasy racism. A lot of my campaign settings were very built on this idea that there were sort of imperial, oppressive races and sort of dark races, right? You know, but like that there's nothing but that there's some level in institutionalized like discrimination or whatever. But I mostly lifted all that out, you know. It's not the kind of thing that I wanted to, that I kind of wanted to focus on. But as I was revamping this, and then a second thing happened. The second thing is, you know, for I have a weekly game with a group of people, some of whom are in the chat. Hey, what's up? Which has been canceled a couple of times, and I basically offered, I was like, hey, if we're gonna cancel, because both of those games are run by Rachel, and I was like, if we're gonna cancel, I can actually prepare a game so that if you need a night off, we can just play my game, essentially, right? And I sort of pitched this last week, and now we're kind of like going through it. So I've been now it's kind of going in two different directions, right? We're revamping this campaign setting for this group of, you know, one group of people, and also for friends in my regular sort of D&D group. And the process of doing this has actually been pretty fun and interesting, because it's a question of like, what makes a good campaign setting, right? Is what I keep asking myself over and over again. Like, what are some of the things that make a good campaign setting? What do I care about? What am I thinking about? How am I orienting, you know, whatever, some of the different sort of like elements. And I guess, I don't know, really, I just want to talk about some of the thought process that went into all of that. I don't know. Does that make sense? Is that a good frame?
It does. I'm curious to see what your thoughts are, like what, like, you know, the way you're framing this is like what makes a good campaign setting. And I don't know if I like have a thing in my head where it's like, oh, well, it's got to have this or got to have that. I think like most of it's pretty flexible and floating. I think there are things that make things better and more memorable, but I don't know how much, like, you know, how granular you can get there. So I'm interested to see what you think.
Yeah, so part of this is definitely that I was thinking about, I'm trying not to think in terms of details. I'm trying to think of in terms of, like, you know, strains of thought in a way.
Okay.
Right? So, for instance, something I was thinking about, I've had this in this idea in my head for a long time. Have I ever explained hooks and anchors to you in, like, in other terms?
It sounds familiar. Why don't you re-explain it for the folks at home?
Okay, so a hook and an anchor, this is something I use in my professional life. A hook and an anchor are two opposite kind of ideas in our, in sort of like the way that we approach new stuff, right? The hook, so to frame this in video game terms, right? So if I'm thinking about an indie game, right? I'm thinking about signing an indie game. I'm thinking about playing an indie game or something like that. That game has to have a hook, right? What is the new, interesting, innovative thing that this game is doing that nobody else is doing, right? And that attracts me to it. So a good example for Astraea would be like the dice, right? Being able to describe an indie game as it's like blank, but with blank is kind of describing your hook, right? It's like, or your hook and your anchor, actually, in a lot of ways.
It's like Uber for pets, right? Like, you know, it's like the classic startup version.
But I say it's like Slay the Spire, but with dice. Dice is the hook, right? Yeah. Dice is the promise of something new and interesting to kind of like go into. The anchor is the opposite, and it's the first part of that sentence, right?
It's like Slay the Spire,
right? Yeah. And a lot of times this is just genre, right? This is the part that explains in very simple terms what is the core thing. You know, if the hook is the new thing that grabs your attention, the anchor is the thing that reassures you, right, that, oh, this is a thing I like. I'm already kind of like on board and engaged with this. And I was thinking a lot about sort of like hooks and anchors when I was like rewriting all of this stuff, because one of the things that I've done for this campaign setting, let's talk about hooks first. One of the things I did for this campaign setting was I very explicitly tried to draw out what I think the hook is, in a couple of different ways. But the core one is that it's built around sort of, it's almost like Victorian in sort of time scale in my head, right? It's a little less medieval fantasy and a little more like industrial fantasy, if that makes sense.
Dieselpunk, because, like WoW range-ish, almost?
Sort of. The idea in lore is that there are these arcane power crystals, right, that have been discovered. You know, arcane power crystals exist. They were sort of, like, inert. Nobody really understood what it did for a long time. And then somebody cracked it and realized, oh, actually, I understand arcane magic, I understand ley lines, I understand these power crystals, and I can charge a power crystal and have it power a thing, right? Sure. So it is sort of the fantasy equivalent of like the understanding of coal and oil, like fossil fuels, as ways to power factories, right? In a similar sort of setting. But the idea is that it comes out of these, you know, like power crystals or whatever. Because I feel like, you know, when I think of like a stereotypical D&D setting, we're thinking very medieval fantasy. Sure. And that's very true, right? Or even you would maybe bump it up to like Renaissance, right?
I mean, it's kind of a pastiche, right? Like, you're getting into the historicity of D&D, it like spans anywhere from like, you know, 900 to like 1800s, right? Like, you know, like you even get like some of the tip of that Victorian era stuff. But anyway.
And so the idea is that there's this arcane revolution going on. And part of that is that arcane magic and wizards are like very new, right? This is something that has only kind of cropped up in the last 100 years. I feel like I like the idea that sort of in the same way that sort of like the Enlightenment changed the, you know, whatever, like kind of like the academic thought processes of history, like medieval history, which is very based on sort of like religion, into something more secular. That's something that I'm kind of mirroring, but with kind of power sources, right? Magic used to just be divine magic, right? You got magic from the gods. The gods gave you your magic, and the only kind of magic was divine magic, right? But now we have this under, you know, like here's a scholar. He says, hey, here are ley lines. You can draw on this to make, you know, arcane magic work or whatever. And so now people can learn to be wizards, and they can learn to, you know, cast spells on their own and that kind of thing, which I think is kind of interesting.
So like, you know, like there's like a couple of old wizards, but only because like, you know, it's like, you know, what the practice of magic is like, how old at this point?
Yeah. Cause the practice of magic would be very old, because there's also other pieces of this too. I can't, because, you know, it's like a rabbit hole or whatever, right?
Sure.
But the very first types of magic are primal magic, right? Druidism, right? Essentially, like druids, rangers, barbarians, that kind of magic, and then that gets superseded by divine magic, just because, you know, I don't know. I don't want to get bogged down in explaining that stuff, obviously, right? But for however many, I don't even remember if it's the scale is definitely thousands of years, but forever, however many thousands of years, right? You know, almost all of the magic in, you know, in the empire would be coming from divine sources.
Right. But the the study of arcane magic is relatively new.
Oh yeah, that's yeah. The idea is that's 100 years is that time frame, right?
Okay.
That we are, you know, kind of. I guess if I were to like put a relatively recent sort of year, it would be like maybe like the late 1800s or something, right?
Okay.
In terms of whatever this like process of sort of fantasy industrialization, right?
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, that is a neat premise. You like sorcerers exist?
Yeah, sorcerers do exist, and so do warlocks, both casting arcane magic and spells. And the idea with sorcerers is that they just appeared randomly and nobody really knew why, and they can cast this shit, but like only that you're like there's no study to that because it's so sort of innate and intuitive.
Right.
That they are kind of like anomalies, right? And then warlocks are interesting because one of these things, you know, this is a thing that I like about D&D settings. I don't like other planes, right?
Sure.
So I don't like the idea that you could go to hell, you could go to whatever, like you could hop in a portal and plane shift to, you know, whatever, the Feywild or something like that, right? But the idea is that there are other divine magic comes explicitly from the gods, but there are other beings who are outside of the material plane who you can contact, right? And they can grant you access to arcane magic, right? So essentially, this would be making a deal with a demon, and the demon teaches you how to cast arcane magic, right? But those are both very intuitive processes rather than very inductive, deductive processes. I don't know.
Yes,
whatever.
Studied,
you know.
Right? Like
exactly
academic.
Right. Yeah. No sorcerer could sit down and teach a non-sorcerer how to cast spells. Is the idea.
Right.
But the idea of a wizard is that you can sit down and teach somebody how to cast spells. That kind of thing. So yeah, and then the other thing is that tieflings and ASMR have a different origin for this same sort of reason. Tieflings are essentially any child that has been sort of suffused with arcane magic is essentially born as a tiefling, and an ASMR is any child that's been suffused with divine magic.
Interesting.
As opposed to you know, being like the offspring of like demons and devils or whatever.
Sure.
Because I like the idea of those things like showing up, but it should be like hard to summon a demon, right? You know, like an occult ritual is needed to summon a demon versus, you know, being able to cast a simple spell in your daily spell slots.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And so just because I'm curious now, did the sorcerers start showing up like 100 years ago, or have they always been around?
They've always been around. So the ley lines have always been around, but people didn't understand them.
Okay.
And part of it is that it's like the application of the scientific method. So for instance, the power crystals exist. The power crystals are in the desert. There's this desert in the bottom. And when they're, it's a little Dune inspired. I'm going to be real with you. Okay. The power crystals are spice mango. Okay. The idea is that there are these constant sandstorms ripping through the desert. And as the sandstorms pull up sand, right? You can actually get the levels of sand low enough that people can go in and they can dig and they can just find all of these power crystals. And the idea was the crystals themselves were just kind of like a neat ornament, right? You know, like a noble would like put one in their house, right? And weird things happened, right? How come when this noble puts the power crystal in his house, it glows faintly, or it's warm to the touch, or something like that, right? Versus, you know, if he takes it somewhere else, right? And the tracking down of the answers to those questions, is what eventually sort of led to the revelations that, it's sitting on a ley line, right? And it's drawing the ambient arcane energy from that ley line. One of the other things is that sorcerers will be born at, like, you know, junctions on a ley line. There's like a detail that I love sort of the idea of, even it's kind of stupid if you think about it, which is that like a house sitting on sort of like a nexus of ley lines would just, kids born in that house would just happen to be sorcerers a lot, right? Because they're sort of sitting on this thing, but nobody would really understand why that's happening. It's just like a weird circumstance, right? Until somebody actually kind of performs the scientific method.
Makes sense. Lou in the chat says, this is like half of my JRPG life. It sounds pretty JRPG. Like a lot of Final Fantasy kind of operates like that, right? Like, you know, okay. Weird mix of like very medieval, but also like, you know, weird industrialization happening at some corner of things, right?
Yeah, like, I guess that's true. It's part of this is that I really like the idea of airships. I've always been a big
That is the
but we didn't even talk about that is the thing. That's all, like, we haven't even got there.
It's just very funny that, like, you're like, I don't know, but I also like airships. It's just like, yeah, okay, put the cherry on the top of it.
Why don't you? I hadn't revealed the most JRPG parts of this setting. You know, this, like, story or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so some of this stuff is what I think of as, like, the hooks, right? But then the anchors are things like, you know, the elves live in the woods, the dwarves live in mountains, you know, humans are everywhere, and they're congenial, and they're nice, and they're kind of like the dominant species, all this kind of stuff, right? Like, this is what I think of as, like, anchors, because part of what I think happens when people are approaching a campaign setting is they want almost the difference between silk and sandpaper, right? You want silk because it's comfortable, right? It's soft, right? But you want sandpaper because it gives you traction. It gives you something to it gives you texture. It gives you something to kind of, like, latch on to in a way. And so some of the stuff I'm sort of, like, designing is this stuff, right? The lore that needs to be explained so that someone could understand, okay, if you want to play a wizard in this universe, here's the rules to that, right? But some of this stuff should be silk. It should just be, yes. Oh, you want to play an elf? Cool. The elves live in the forest. They like druids and rangers and nature, and that's what they're like. You know what I mean? It's like, that's very intuitive. People just immediately understand that, right? Which I think is, I don't know, like, that's like part of the give and take. Also, I just wholesale rip off certain, this is the other thing about this campaign setting. There are just Skaven here, just because I like Skaven, and I'm just ripping them off from Warhammer.
Sure. yeah.
Stuff like that.
And then you're not publishing it, so you can even call them Skaven if you want, right? Like,
The Skaven are in the mountains, and when I was drawing, I had this, like, map, you know, honestly, I could probably pull it up. I have this like, map, and I wanted to write the Skaven Under Empire, because it's, like, the name of it, right? You'd call the Under Empire. Skaven have been fighting against Dragonborn. They're taking over these Dragonborn have mountain cities, volcanic citadels. Skaven have been fighting the Dragonborn for a long time, driving them out of these volcanic citadels, taking over that space as their own. So they're in these, like, southern mountains. But then I decided that it would actually be more accurate to just write rats on, like, their section of the map. The woodworker and me listening to Buddy describe why you like sandpaper. I'm describing the difference. It's a metaphor, okay? it's a metaphor.
Interesting. It just is something that occurs to me. It's like, it is funny to me that, like, we don't have an Underdark in the real world, right? Like, but because D&D did it, like, everybody else is like, oh, there's a secret underground world where all the underground guys live, and, you know, it's like a whole other world. And it's, you know, not a thing that, like, really happens that often. I don't know. I just think that's super funny.
We know more about space than we do about, or what, there's, like, some Carl Sagan quote about this, right? Well, like, we know more about distant stars than we do about our own core of the Earth or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's usually, like, the depths of the ocean, like, that too.
Oh, that's also true. Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, you know, we do know that there aren't, like, a ton of holes, you know. It's not like a giant cave system. I mean, unless you believe in, like, Hollow Earth or whatever, but, you know, I don't think either of us do.
Yeah, I mean, there's that one hole that the Soviet, you know about this? The Soviet Union just drilled a hole to see as deep as they possibly could for the sole scientific purpose of, let's see how, if we just keep drilling down, let's see how deep it goes, kind of thing. It's like a famous fucking hole, but eventually it got so hot that it kept melting their drill bits, I'm pretty sure, and they had to stop.
Lula Chet says, I believe the Earth is both hollow and flat. Well, so let me tell you, Lou, about former flat Earth theory, which is essentially this. It's that the world was flat, and then it got hit by, like, a comet, and it wrapped around itself. And so now it's a hollow Earth. So former flat Earth theory, Lou, look it up.
Have you ever... I wonder what playing a true flat Earth... Like, could you make a D&D campaign out of a flat Earth?
Yeah, it's called the Discworld series by Terry Pratchett.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. That's a great example.
Right. Like, I mean, and you know, if you read like the first book, he lays out a lot of stuff. It's like, you know, Turnwise and Widdershins, right? Like, you know, and everything's kind of like oriented around the, like the hub is like temperate and the rim is alternatingly like, no, the hub is cold and the rim is tropical, I believe. Yeah. You know,
yeah. Yeah, the Underdark is actually a pretty good example of something that's pretty of something that's pretty interesting, because like I was thinking about this in WoW terms as well, right? Like, you know, if I think of like the Warcraft universe as a campaign setting, the Warcraft universe takes a lot of sort of its cues from D&D, right?
Right.
And we sort of have that now, right? You have you can have Zerolek Cavern, which is, you know, kind of like the Underdark. The whole next, you know, expansion is built on sort of going into whatever, sort of like the Underdark, which is traditionally not a part of D&D lore that I love all that much, just because, like, I don't even know if I would call it, like, practical, but there's something about, like, wouldn't it just fill with water? How does the Underdark not just fill with water? Has that ever been answered?
I don't think all things below sea level automatically fill with water. I mean, there's only so much water. Like, you know, there are, like, aquifers, but not everything's necessarily an aquifer. Also, like,
it just feels like if the world is actually hollow and there is the Underdark and oceans are also huge and vast, you would just think, like, think about the weight of the ocean, right? Are we saying that that's being cradled by, like, a lattice of, like, granite or something like that? It would be wild. It'd be so heavy.
You know what I mean? But, like, the pressure wouldn't be directly, like, you know, assuming, I don't know what how canonically deep the Underdark is, but assuming it, like, you know, that, like, you know, maybe a dwarf once, like, you know, made a wrong turn and ended up drowning his, like, you know, his city. But, like, if there's, like, a large enough distance, if it's, like, one is probably not as deep as the oceans, but as long as it doesn't get close enough to the, like, because, you know, the oceans are also oceans to the Underdark. They're just, like, oceans that are with, like, a wall of stone in between them, right? Like,
okay, I guess that's true. Yeah, maybe the Underdark is as deep as the oceans. The Underdark is at its deepest around 10 miles underground. Okay, wow, interesting. But yeah, maybe the Underdark is just under the continents themselves, right?
Yeah. So
there's no ocean to spill into, I guess.
Yeah.
That's maybe fair enough. I would maybe accept that as a, you know, as an explanation. Yeah, that's something that I've been thinking about when it comes to sort of like this campaign setting is like, what are some of the things about D&D that are realistic, like unrealistic, that bother me that I want to fix, right? And the Underdark is kind of secretly one of those. I like the idea of Underdark, not Underdark, but like underground cities in terms of like the mountains. Like, I love the idea of like Moria, right? The Mines of Moria is a fantastic example, or like Erebor or whatever, right? You know, we're dwarves, we hollow out the inside of this mountain and we make the thing, even though in this campaign setting it's dwarves and dragonborn who do that. But I don't know how much I like the idea of a true sort of like network of Underdark, even though I also do like that idea.
Rich in the chat says, I mean, I think the idea of it is just a dude went into a cave and was like, bro, this is crazy.
yeah, that's really all it takes.
Yeah. That is maybe the Doyleist explanation, but, you know, still room for the Watsonian one as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Watsonian is like the in-universe, the diegetic explanation. Doyleist is like the author-level explanation.
Yeah,
that makes
sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think I like the idea of, like, you know, honestly, the thing I like about dwarves and dragonborn and skaven or whatever as sort of like an underground dwelling race is less that they live underground and is more that they kind of craft communities underground. Like, I have this section when it talks about like dwarves, how, you know, the dwarves live in this plateau. It's very Russian. These are like very Russian dwarves. They live on this plateau and there's not a lot of and they're like shepherds. Right, it's not a lot of arable farmland or whatever in these steppes, and so they need every ounce of real estate in order to, like, you know, whatever, let their yaks feed and shit like that. And so they built their homes underground as a space saving mechanism, right? You know, you just can't dedicate square footage that would otherwise go to feeding fucking yaks to this, so they built underground homes or whatever, like in cities or whatever. Yeah, your drow live in swamps. How dare you take away our giant caverns and give them to rats? That's true. The drow do live in swamps. But I love the idea of a swamp. This comes from a very specific thing of, I love the idea of drow as a slave society, and I love the idea as a slave society mirrored on the antebellum South with New Orleans as its sort of center, like as its cultural center.
So the drow are slavers then, and but did they enslave other drow?
They enslave everybody. Okay. They're also pirates. Part of the drow is that they are pirates, and they get on ships and they go on big pirate, you know, slaving expeditions where they go just like round up a bunch of slaves, and they have easy slaves. They can get Skaven, they can get goblins or whatever. But like, oh boy, you get me a Leonin slave, right? That's the good shit, right? You know, you get me humans and stuff like that. That's what it comes down to. They're equal opportunities assholes. Yes, absolutely. And I don't know. It's one of those things where. I try and think about the different. I'm sorry. Let me back up. Do you know the city of Sharn? Do you know Eberron?
I'm not super familiar with Eberron, though. No.
God, man, could I? I feel like I could explain this in just like one image. This is like the whole basis of my whole sort of kind of thing. Sharn is a city in canyons. It's called the City of Towers or whatever. And it's a vertical city, right? And I remember when I was a kid, I learned about Sharn and I thought it was the coolest shit. Because the idea is that there's the lower city, right? There's the depths of the canyons, right? And then there's like the upper city and then the, you know, like the top, the canopy of the city or whatever. And it very much got me thinking about like, how can you make cities that are like interesting that aren't just like, you know, I don't know, whatever, Minas Tirith, sure. Right, or something like that. And so Sharn is a really good example of something that I'm always trying to sort of like emulate. And so the idea of fantasy New Orleans as drow slavers, as the centerpiece of drow slave society, I don't know. It's just been in my brain for a long. It's been in my brain for a long fucking time.
Yeah. No. That. I get it. I understand why it would be. You know that sounds. It sounds interesting. It sounds very cool and idiosyncratic. I think you've got like enough of that kind of like hook and anchor thing there, right? Like the hook is that they're swamp Cajuns, and the anchor is that they are slavers. And otherwise still kind of like horrific evil drow.
Yeah, that's true. Are there things that you think every campaign setting like should have? Like what are some like must haves in a campaign setting, do you think?
What do you mean? Like
I don't know. I'm just okay. Interested in
wherever
you want to take
that. I'm going to pull some of this from something that the Angry GM talks about, is that non-human races need to have like a very kind of like identifiable different culture, and like 98% of them have to be that, right? Like, you know, because otherwise there's kind of not a point in having them. Otherwise they're just kind of like humans with slightly different stats.
That's a really interesting perspective. Oh my god.
Basically the idea is that like humans are the adaptable ones, and they're the ones that can be like all sorts of different and all sorts of varied. But like 98% of dwarves should be dwarves, right? Like, you know, and most of the time that should be the classic version of it, right? Like if you've got a good, compelling alternate version, I think that works too. But like, other, like if every dwarf can be just like whoever they like, can just be like as varied as a human, then at some point it's just kind of like, why? Right.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, the original version of this was very much like that, right? Where the whole idea was that, you know, so there's this empire. Empire was first conquered by the Dragonborn, and then it was sort of reformed to be a little bit more egalitarian later. And it looks a little bit like the United States would today, right?
Sure.
In the sense that there are different provinces, and the different provinces of the empire had were very racially coded, right? So there is the Greenreach, it is the Forest, and it is the Elven Province, right? But something I've actually toned that back in the recent iteration of this, partially because I'm trying to get rid of some of this like fantasy racism stuff. I just like don't want to get into.
Sure.
That was sort of the old hook of the campaign was the Empire used to essentially systematically reject all races from outside of the Empire, right? You know, you had humans and elves and dwarves. They're safe. They can be citizens of the Empire. But, like, everybody else are rejects, and they get essentially deported, right? And then the new thing, the hook is that, you know, they essentially pass, like, a piece of legislation passes that basically says, hey, we'll take in refugees, and a huge flood of different races come from all over the continent, right? So, you know, you have drow and you have half orcs and you have all these other sorts of people who are kind of like coming into the Empire, and it's about dealing with the friction of sort of that. I got rid of like all that stuff because I would just, say like,
that sounds like, a little close to home.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff that I like. There's a lot of stuff that I've always like liked, and there's some of that stuff that still exists, right?
For instance,
I've always liked the idea of half-orcs as not, I mean, frankly, I think the origin of a half-orc being a human-orc pairing to be a little, I don't know, like rapey, well, I guess.
I would say, like, so this is before, you know, the idea. This is the thing the angry GM says that I frankly don't like a lot. I don't particularly agree with. But it's like, you know, when you had a designated antagonist race, right? Like, you know, if orcs were always evil, right, then that kind of thing made sense as a plot contrivance, because like there weren't a lot of happy unions there, right? Like, maybe it's a little gross because you're introducing like at least an implicit sexual violence element, but as kind of like, you know, we've moved forward, there was kind of a, I actually think it's not born out of like, you know, any sort of kind of like push for, you know, DEI or anything. I think just kind of like people think orcs are cool and they want to play as orcs, but also not want to feel like pieces of shit for playing orcs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so the thing I like about the idea of a half orc is sort of like a, I mean, this is something I've featured in our games before, right? You know, Regdar the Red, right? That was in Hell's Rebels, right? Or maybe, did I not use this for Hell's Rebels? I have this idea of a character who I use a lot. His name is Regdar the Red. He's sort of a cross between like Martin Luther King and like Genghis Khan, right? He basically thinks that half-orcs have been subjugated, and so he browns up all of the half-orcs into a big giant caravan and just moves them around, right? Because, and so they just sort of roam around as this horde of whatever, 10,000 half-orcs. But the idea in my head is always that those are half-orcs who are, you know, they come from a long line of essentially half-orcs, right?
Sure.
It's not that there are new human-orc pairings who are creating half-orcs that are getting added to the caravan. It is that they are sort of their own race that is sort of pejoratively called half-orcs, right? And almost always the idea is that they are essentially in like, you know how like in Sparta, in like 300 or whatever, they throw the baby off a cliff because he's like a runt. Like, orcs have essentially runts, and they call the runts half-orcs, and those are an underclass in orcish society, and they eventually kind of like rebel and leave, and this is sort of what explains that. This is always one of my approaches when it comes to like race stuff, because, you know, I don't know. Even half-elves are actually like this. Half-elves are not a human-elf pairing. They are essentially they're essentially just elves, but who have a different name because they have like a different society and culture. Like, the elves think of themselves as true elves, and they think of them as half elves, and these are people who have essentially taken on a pejorative slur as the name for their species and kind of co-opted it to say, hey, actually, no, we're great. We're essentially high elves, and this is great.
Okay. And so, like, I guess your world then doesn't have any sort of, like, not that it's, like, particularly important, but doesn't have any sort of, like, interbreeding, or if they do, it comes out just as, like, one.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I sort of think, if I'm being super honest with you, I don't think the science ever makes sense. Maybe it's just because I understand, like, the nature of a mule or something. But that's more or less exactly what I sort of expect. It would be like, yeah, sure, you could have like a pairing, but then you would probably identify with one, you know, kind of like dominant culture in the same sort of ways that like Pathfinder has ancestries or whatever they call them now.
Yeah.
It would be something similar. Like, yeah, sure, if you wanted to play like a half elf that is a half human, half elf, like you know, human dad, elf mom, you could, but in my head that is not a stable you are sterile and you cannot reproduce.
Sure.
Is that fucked up? I don't know. To sit down and explain that, to be honest.
No, I mean, I am hesitant to, like, I don't know. There are some, I think, species that can breed true across species lines. I am not super sure about that. Also, there's kind of like the, you know, the broccoli question, right? Like, you know, we call these things different. Like, you know, theoretically, humans, elves, and dwarves could be like a broccoli, you know, cauliflower and kale, which are all the same plant, but with like different genes expressed.
I guess that's true. Yeah.
Buddy, you're messing with my fantasy race breeding king. Yeah. I mean, also, you know, it's magic, right? Like, you know, I don't think too hard about like the fan, you know, the,
yeah,
those sure. aspects. Yeah.
You know, let's just say that they exist, but people sort of go one way or the other. It probably makes sense. Yeah. There's a part of me that also wants to protect, like, one of the things that happens when you code fantasy races culturally, right, which obviously the Angry GM sort of suggests, and I definitely engage in some of that, like when I'm talking about Russian dwarves or whatever, is that you also are sort of presenting the option of playing, like, a biracial character, essentially. You know, if you have a dwarf mom and a human dad, right, it might inform your character in unique or interesting ways. And there's probably a lot of like room and space for that. So yeah, the hilarious part is I'm typically pretty anti-halvesies. Yeah. You know what? Fair enough. So yeah.
Hold on. I gotta deal with this nonsense. How do I deal with this person? Ban. Sorry. Let me explain to my elf GF that I believe I can get her pregnant if we just try hard enough despite being a cis woman.
You know, listen. Anyway, I'm sorry. We talked about that. Does that answer your question about like the fantasy races stuff?
That was my suggestion that, like...
I guess, sure.
Yeah, that, like, you know, like, that non-human cultures need to be strongly defined, and they mostly need to be... Which I think it sounds like you're basically following that path, right? Like, you know, something that's interesting, again, this is, like, another kind of trope, is that, like, you know, elves kind of hold the superposition of being, like, either, like, wizard scholars or, like, tree huggers, right? And, like, you know... And
I'm definitely splitting the difference because half elves are wizard scholars and right. elf elves are tree huggers.
Everybody finds a way to split the difference, right? Like 40K yeah. has them as like different civilizations, right? Like, you know, most of the D&D like just kind of like, and some of them are like that way and some of them are like the other way. And like, and I think the more recent editions, both PFDE and 5e are pretty good about like, you know, just like letting you pick one. Whereas like the earlier editions, like tried to like take half from both and like, you know, you figure it out, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, fourth edition had Eladrin, right? They separated it out into elves and Eladrin. Elves were essentially, you know, tree huggers, and Eladrin were, you know, what we would think of as like high elves, right?
Yeah, except they were also like extra planar aliens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what the other thing is. I really don't like. I really don't like the idea of like extraplanar stuff. Or I guess I, you know, actually, this is interesting. This is something where I think I actually have to retroactively disagree with myself. I used to say that the gods are silent was my preferred sort of like way to do D&D stuff, right? You know, that that it was just like, I don't know. I don't even remember how I used to describe it or whatever. But then you had this other opposite thing, which was that, you know, like the gods exist because an atheist in one situation is, I'm like butchering the fuck out of this. An atheist is more interesting if gods are real and they yeah. reject them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And atheist is interesting because it's a choice to reject. Yeah. The only person who can tell Buddy he's wrong. Buddy.
Yeah, because this came down to whatever the fucking in the Hell's Rebels game, there was that empire, that atheist empire. I can't remember what they're called, but they they hate gods.
Yeah, it's one of the, it's like the North African equivalent.
Yeah, I made them Lanin because I like Lanin. Yeah. I think Lanin are neat and fun.
Rahadum, maybe?
Right, yeah, Rahadoom. Yes, absolutely. Right, rhinos is the thing that I really hit on. I actually think that's an idea that I got from Rachel, is that their mount of choice are rhinoceros. They are not horses, which is ridiculous. It makes, like, no sense, but it's so fucking cool, the idea.
Oh, so, you can't have a half elf, but you can have rhino cavalry.
But you can have, like, rhino. Listen, yes. You know what, Mango? Fucking, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the Leyden are in this one too. The Leyden actually are interesting. I think part of what I was thinking about is I was thinking about alignment, right? I was like, what are the different alignments of some of the different sort of like other, so you have the Empire and then you have like other sort of nations outside the Empire, right? So you have kind of chaotic evil, you know, you have confederated goblin tribes, right? Who are just doing goblin, orc, you know, bugbear, all that stuff is just happening. They're just tribes. They're fucking around, right? You know, you kind of have the lawful evil of like the drow would be a good example of this, right? Or even just the neutral evil, like Skaven were probably just neutral evil, right? Maybe they're honestly chaotic evil. But I had this idea for, God, you would love this shit so much. I had this idea for sort of a lawful good evil empire that is sort of, it's not Russian, because the dwarves are Russian, okay? So it's not Russian. But it is very oppressively kind of Soviet, which is the idea that the empire is lawful good, okay? And it does, in fact, believe in the greater good, right? But the greater good is actually dystopian, because you have no rights, and the empire tells you what to do at all times. Sure. And yes, it's doing these things essentially for your benefit. That's good. It is a lawful good empire, but it is also fundamentally wrong. And like most people would think that living in a situation like that, or living in a, I'm sorry, like a society like that would be oppressive and terrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, it's like top-down organization, right? Like maybe FDR-ish, right? Like, which is like,
okay, well, listen, let's not besmirch one of the greatest presidents of all time, Mango. Okay. I'm just kidding.
No, but I do want to, like, I want to say, so in the chat, Arahe says, lions riding rhinos, yes, elves and humans boning down. No, you missed an opportunity, Arahe. It should be lions riding rhinos, yes, elves riding humans, no, right?
Oh my God, that's so true. Oh my God, yeah. Jesus. You're so right. You know what? That's actually really funny.
But anyway, to get back to your serious point about the oppressive empire. Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. It's just, so like, actually, it's kind of interesting because it's like, you know, flavors of maybe a little bit of like Chelyax, which is like the PF2E kind of like, because PF2 in Chelyax is like, you know, pretty definitionally lawful evil, but the way it's kind of played is like the humans aren't necessarily all, like the citizenry isn't necessarily all up to date on like exactly what's happening there, right? Like, you know, they don't necessarily understand the extent of what that means. Because it sounds like almost like a lawful neutral society that is like shooting for good, but like maybe missing the mark sometimes, right? Like, because like, let's say you grow up in the empire and you decide, you know, how like control this is, like you get your job assigned at like, you know, at birth, you get assigned like after enough, like you get your job assigned, you get to choose.
That's actually sort of an interesting question. So the place is called the Leyden Hierarchy, right?
Sure.
And the idea in my head is that everybody has someone sort of above them that they're answering to, and someone who they are, you know, they are kind of like ordering around, right? Like definitionally. But it's almost sort of like, imagine a world where you could sort of write out, let's say, kind of like greed and like corruption, right? In sort of a Tolkien-esque way. If you could say those are specifically human traits, those are not traits shared by like the elves, or for instance, right? What would sort of that society look like? And so the idea is that, yes, your whole life is sort of defined by the nature of the hierarchy. You have essentially a master, right, who is dictating everything about what you're doing and how you're doing it. But this is a person who genuinely does sort of care about you and your well-being. You just have no civil rights. It's actually sort of an interpretation along the idea of, if the lawful chaos access describes freedom versus tyranny, right? If we were to use that as a if we were to use that as a framework and say, okay, you can have a good tyrant, that that defines sort of like the latent hierarchy.
Sure. And like presumably like 98% of the people are happy with this arrangement, right? Like they enjoy their way of life and they are not, they don't have a problem with it. And like, what is it? Like, it's not quite a benevolent dictator. Like Luce is the benevolent dictator, but the thing about a benevolent dictator is like a benevolent dictator isn't necessarily this rigid of a society, right? Like,
yeah. And a benevolent dictator, I think, has overtones of like benevolent has like a live and let live connotation, which is not true here, right? Like the empire is explicitly telling you what to do kind of at all times, right? But it's also providing for you in ways that other empires wouldn't, right? There is poverty and crime that exists in, I'm sorry, I'm using the term empire in non-specific ways, in the empire that we're talking about with seven provinces and where all the dragonborn and humans live, right? There is poverty and crime there because this is theoretically, you know, kind of a true neutral society that has a bunch of different sort of like leanings in different ways. and it guarantees some of your civil rights, but it doesn't guarantee your right to not die of starvation.
Sure.
Right. Doesn't guarantee your civil right to not get raided by bandits. Right. You know, there are things that account for some of that stuff and that, try and prevent some of that stuff. But like at the end of the day, that level of freedom also means that, you know, there's a certain amount of freedom to starve. Right.
Yeah.
In the Leyden hierarchy, there isn't that freedom. It will take care of your basic needs and even probably, you know, kind of like some of your more, it's part of it is also like theocratic. Right. One of the aspects of this whole thing is that, you know, like there are set sort of like pantheon of gods. All of the gods are worshipped in the empire. All of the gods are worshipped in the empire, right? But the Leynin only worship one god. They worship the goddess of light, who's also the god of order. And it's sort of a thing of like, when you have an entire society that is oriented to kind of the extreme, with no counterpositions, right? You end up here with sort of like what the Leyden hierarchy is doing. Whereas the humans are also, you know, worshiping the goddess of light, but they worship the goddess of light and the goddess of shadow as a duality. They're sisters, right? In kind of like human interpretation. And so it has this sort of bimodal kind of, or maybe bifocal would be a better term for it, kind of like disposition. That allows for some amount of dissent, right, or debate among, you know, I don't know, their ideology.
No, that makes sense. And the Leyden Empire is just very rigid, very... I'm curious, what... So in this Leyden Empire, if let's say you're born and you just, like, don't quite mesh with the society and you try... You don't want to do it anymore, what, like, do they just, like, execute you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I probably think exile, because like part of my thinking, part of this is that, you know, Leynin are a playable race in D&D 5e, right? Like they have rules for playing Leynin and Loxodon, who are also represented here. Loxodon being elephant people. And I imagine that in like the Empire itself, there are probably a certain amount of like Leynin expats, right? I don't, like there are no Skaven. Skaven would be killed on sight, right? Lizardmen would be killed on sight. Right. But like, yeah, you could theoretically play a whatever, like a Leynin or a Drow in the Empire who is sort of rebelling against the oppressive society from without that you don't want to be a part of anymore.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, you could also, I think you could see a version of things where like any Leynin might be like, you know, they were instructed to go be a mercenary and bring in income and bring it back, you know, to the city. Yeah. Right. Like, you know, they're mighty warriors. They might as well use that talent. Right. Like.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there's a part of it that's also built off the Qandari from Dragon Age, who have a very similar sort of society set up that I'm just kind of, like, aping here.
Sure.
I kind of like it a lot, but I think Qandari are lame and Leynin are fucking cool. They ride rhinos, okay? But I also needed bad guys for Kovalgrad was the important thing. And so the idea of making kind of, like, lawful good fascists as the Nazis while you are playing kind of lawful evil sort of Soviet Union... I don't know, the dwarves, like I said, the dwarves are Russian, but they're kind of too Russian in two ways. They're like serfs and boyars, right? You know, like pre-World War I, super oppressive Russians. And then also there are these big cities, the cities are called furnace cities because all they do is just like crazy amounts of industrial production. Those are sort of Soviet cities, or like, you know, those are sort of like if you were living in an oppressive, brutalist Eastern European block in the 1950s.
That also sounds like it could be like, you know, Industrial Revolution, like England, right? Like, you know, like,
I guess it is, because I think I call them robber barons. That the people at the top of these cities are sort of these merchant princes who are sort of the robber barons, and there's a little bit of stuff with I don't know. It's also, you know, whatever, but it is
So and so like. I would say, like, how do these figure into your campaign? And the campaign is, like, a fight between the Dwarven and the Leonin.
Well, so, yeah, so Kovalgrad itself is the Leonin. So Kovalgrad is on a river. It's on the Koval River. And it has three bridges. It's a city with three bridges. And the Leonin basically need to take this city in order to access the bridges to cross the river in, like, a true way, right? There is an Imperial Legion, right? Like, the Imperial Legion is the military or whatever, but, like, there is a unit of, like, one legion of the Imperial Legion, right? I think I call it a division or something like that. Like, one division of the Imperial Legion that sits in Kovalgrad. And they took such heavy casualties defending the east side of the river, which I unironically called the East Bank and the West Bank before all of this Israel-Palestine stuff. And I have renamed that part. But, like, they took such heavy casualties on the east side of the river, and they haven't gotten reinforcements yet, that they've just started conscripting refugees from the town. So the idea is that, you know, the Legion is going to refugee camps and just conscripting everybody they can find to fight in to fight against the Leonin and protect these bridges. And the player characters are conscripted in this way.
Yeah. Okay. So the backdrop is that the Leonin are in a war against the Empire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, basically, all of the other nations are at constant states of war with the Empire. There really is no trade. Like, there's trade between the Imperial provinces, but there's really there's no trade with the Drow, right? You know, you don't trade with people who are enslaving you, right? There's no trade with the Lizardmen. The Lizardmen in the South are also lifted straight from Warhammer because I like them. But part of the thing I like about the Lizardmen is nobody understands them. Nobody can speak the Lizardmen language. No one has ever, the Lizardmen never care about the Imperial stuff. They're just doing their shit in the jungle in the South, and it's weird, and nobody gets it, and they just kind of want to be left alone, but they also will sometimes steal Imperial citizens and use them as human sacrifices in their crazy alien whatever, right? It's like, you can't trade with you can't trade with that. You can't trade with Skaven, right? That's one of the, I don't know, that's like, I guess another kind of like core pillar is that basically you're at war with everybody besides the other Imperial provinces.
See, this is interesting because this is the thing I think about sometimes. It's like, how much does a setting benefit from like otherwise being relatively at peace, or like the threat is not, you know, interfactional, right? It's like, you know, maybe something grander, but it's like not like a thing that like, you know, you don't have to worry about like kind of like the petty war stuff, right? Like, you know, because like your classic kind of fantasy TTRPG is like you meet in a tavern and like the problem's very local. Maybe it grows in scale, but it's not like, you know, an international threat, or it might be an international threat, but it's not like an international incident. If it's international, it's only in the sense that it's affecting more than one nation. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Go on.
One of the things that I don't want, one of the things that is not written into this setting at the moment is a true sort of like mobilization or like, a state of total war in the Empire. It's more like constant border skirmishes, right? Even though, you know, the Empire and the Leonin are at war and they are fighting over Kovalgrad, it's really just the story of like one division that is trying its best to defend Kovalgrad. And maybe it would be worse if Kovalgrad falls and the Leonin bust through and they start taking over huge swaths of Dwarven territory, right? but like, it's not like it would be a, it's sort of a good representation of like the 30 Years' War, which was you know, a period of warfare, but that was playing out through small disconnected battles, you know, taking place over a very, very long period of time, versus something like World War II, where like the entire country mobilizes for war. And, you know, for 5 years, all the whole world is built around is the concept of warfare against other kind of like grand nations, right? Most people in the empire aren't thinking about warfare. They're not dealing with warfare, right? It is just kind of a thing that is kind of chewing away at the it's constantly gnawing away at the borders, right? You have lizardmen sorting parties journeying north and stealing halfling caravans to get human sacrifices for their crazy weird arcane shit. You know, you have Skaven who are laying siege to dragonborn cities and taking them one at a time. But that's like a slow war of attrition, right? Where just like, you know, Every decade, a new volcanic citadel falls, and the Skaven, you know, advance 1 inch. Right? You have slavers coming from the Drow or whatever that are just like going along the coast in half-elven fishing villages and stealing everybody in that village or enslaving everybody in that village to bring back to Thyrax to, you know, be sold, that kind of stuff.
And the kind of like the magic industrial revolution. Is that a thing that's affected everybody, or is this like a thing centered in the empire?
No. Oh, well, so, okay, interestingly, two things. One, mostly no. The power crystals are localized to that desert, right? It's like the halfling desert. The halflings have these caravans. They roam around the desert so that they don't, you know, you can't have a city in the desert because the sandstorms would just like wreck you, sure. Right? There's one city on the coastline and that's it in like the whole desert. And so, that's where the power crystals are. It's like the only source of them, essentially. But the lizardmen absolutely are using what are essentially power crystals. And I'm gonna tease a little bit of lore. There's some secrets to this setting, right? When I envision the setting, there's some stuff that I'm like, this is a secret that I'm gonna probably hold until I ever run a campaign that is about uncovering like this secret. But one of the things that is kind of clear is that the lizardmen understand arcane magic and have been casting arcane magic and using arcane magic for a long time. And so they have access to sort of this stuff. They just don't use it. Right. In the empire, they want to make essentially, you would call them like they want to make like tanks and battleships, right? Sure. Airships, right. With this stuff, the lizardmen are making weird shit that nobody understands. And then the other thing is that the Skaven steal power crystals and then they warp them with fucked up magic to make warpstone, which is just a core part of Warhammer fantasy lore that I have to import if I'm importing the Skaven. And it just happens to dovetail pretty nicely. It also means that like in the Skaven sort of hold the southern mountains that border the desert. So there's reason for Skaven to be like going into the desert and like fucking on, you know, some of the mining operations, some of the dune sandworm, you know, spice crawlers that are sweeping up all of the power crystals. But the Leonin, the Drow, none of these other sort of societies are dealing with arcane stuff in the same way.
Interesting. Okay, very cool.
What do you think about God? What is your position on gods? What's your favorite way to do gods in a campaign setting?
Gods. Kind of, so gods are real but not super present, right? Like they grant divine magic and like, you know, maybe like if the story is appropriate, they'll like do a direct contact type thing, but like they're usually distant and like, you know, but them being real is like means that like you kind of have to, if you're choosing to worship one, it has to be because you agree with their ideals rather than like, you know, like say the kind of traditional Christian God is like the arbiter of morality. Like if you believe in that, right? Like, you know, it's, you know, it is good because God says it is good, or, you know, because he sees it's good, you know, however you choose to interpret that kind of thing. But you can't really do that in like a, you know, pantheon type way, right? Like, I mean, you could say that these things are good in such that your deity values it. I think just for kind of like epic story, for like traditional fantasy storytelling purposes, it makes sense. It is better for like some gods just to be like evil and like be like, you know, maybe not like, you know, like cacklingly evil all the time, but like, you know, worshippers of Rovagug, which is a Pathfinder 2E god, probably know that they're up to some bad shit, right? Like they're, you know, they're like into destruction, right? Like worshippers of like the devils, right? Like the princes of hell, right? They are, no, they're making the trade-off. They're doing something that is convenient at the cost of their souls, right? Like, you know.
Right.
I think having, like, kind of, like, relatively clear morality like that is good for kind of, like, making the story work better, right? Like, I think there's a place for kind of, like, a very complex morality. But I think that's just, like, I think if you're going to do any sort of, like, divine magic, you kind of have to have everything be relatively legible, at least. Otherwise, you get into like messy situations that I don't think work super well.
That's interesting. That sort of runs alongside some of the things that I think about, but it also runs against it. Like, one of the things that I am sort of striving for is you can be a cleric of any god and choose any domain as part of that god, right? So the idea is there's eight of them. They are diametrically opposed and along sort of like, we would call them like primeval elements, right? You know, light, shadow, earth, air, fire, water, life, death, right? But that all of those gods have different aspects of themselves. And if you wanted to play, for instance, a, I don't know, what would be like a good example of this? Like a healing cleric under the death god, you could. You just have to make a sort of an argument for interpretation of death, the death god's sort of ethos to make that happen. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
One of the things that I like the idea of is I like the idea of denominations. You know, Christianity has this, where there's one God, there's one Bible, but you have Baptists and Episcopalians and Presbyterians, right? You have Mormons, you have all these different sorts of like offshoot religions that are like built on sort of like one core foundational ideal. I feel like most D&D gods tend to be based off of the idea of like a pantheon of gods that are set around like the Greek gods or the Norse gods, right? But in my head, this is more set around the idea of like Christianity or like Sunni Shia Muslim, you know, like denominations, right? Like there are two you know, you can have a temple to Cyrexis, the death god, that worships his aspect as the god of time and his aspect as the god of justice. Do you know what I mean? And those are two different denominations of the same core text.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing that rings a little strange to me about that kind of thing, right? Because I also, like, you know, I played a character in a game that was kind of, like, based on, like, the idea was that he was the fringe interpretation of religion, right? But, the thing you're talking about with, like, you know, the different interpretations of Christianity kind of works because, you know, the big man is silent, right? Like, you know, if you've got, like, you know, two, let's say, radically different views of this god Cyrexis, right? And those clerics both pray to this god, and they are both granted powers. At some level, they don't really have anything to fight about. It's like, well, obviously, these are both valid, you know, forms of worship of Cyrexis because he's blessing both of them by granting us power.
Right? Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess I would say you wouldn't be able to. That's really interesting. And that's really fair. I think you wouldn't be able to say, pray to Cyrexis and say, I am a cleric of crime and I want to do crime. Give me spells to do crime, right? He's the god of justice. He doesn't tolerate criminals, right? But if you were to pray to, if you were to be a cleric of trickery and you were to pray to Cyrexis and you're saying, I am using the weapon of my enemy against them, like an undercover agent or something like that, right? And the idea is that you are going to engage in trickery and deceit in order to bring, you know, whatever.
The greater good or something.
Tricksters. Yeah. Tricksters and deceivers to justice. The Cyrexis would probably agree with you. Because part of it is interpretational. Like, the gods are, you know, the gods are silent, but they do exist. But the way that they communicate is through prophets, right? So gods will periodically kind of anoint mortals on the mortal plane with tremendous power, and these become prophets of a god. So, like, you know, like there's one of the features in the game is one of the proto campaigns is called the Prophet of Cyrexis, and the idea is that there's a little kid in a human town, and people realize that this child is the new prophet of Cyrexis, and the party has to sort of, in a like Last of Us maybe kind of way, or like a Looper sort of way, like protect this child from all of the forces that are going to try and harness their power for whatever to their own ends, right? And the very first prophets wrote Bibles, so you have like the Bible of Cyrexis or the Book of Cyrexis, right? And there are like different interpretations of what that means, but because it's all filtered through sort of the process of, oh, here's a prophet, and then also they're you know, writing works, and we're interpreting works from thousands of years ago in the modern day. What does it mean? Oh, well, actually, you know, when Cyrexis has this passage about justice, it allows me the opportunity to whatever, I don't know, do different sorts of things. I kind of want to feel like I want to leave all of that open, because I think that's really like interesting, fertile ground.
Sure. And I think there's a way to do that with, like, you know, a permissive enough god structure, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, I don't know, like you describe this as kind of like you describe the different Christian and Muslim denominations. You can't really have internecine conflict, right? Like, at least over kind of like over spiritual matters, right? You can't look at, you know, a different denomination say, like, you are false worshipers of this god because he's granting you both powers, right? Like, you know, the god is. And so, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Like, you know, it just, if I wanted to design a thing, like a game that played with those kinds of things, I'd need to figure out a way to kind of, like, make that work, right? Like, I mean, the easiest thing I can think of is, like...
Yeah, I see what you're saying, right? So a conflict between Protestants and Catholics is two people disagreeing over the...
Yeah, the proper interpretation of the Bible, right? Like, you know.
Right.
Like...
And but, so, yeah, the interesting thing is I do... Because it is a pantheon, right? And when I'm thinking about conflicts, I'm thinking about inter-God, like inter-God conflicts, not intra-God conflicts. So, like, right. For instance, like the thing about... the Light God, Shadow God, these are both human gods, and they have human followers that are opposed to one another, right? But those are sort of two different gods, right? They're two different, essentially, denominations, like, warring against one another. I haven't thought all that much about the idea of, like, what does it look like when, you know, a group of, you know, like, two denominations internal to the same god are fighting one another.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Lou in the chat brings up that you could have, like, one side of the conflict being deceived, or lying. I guess that makes sense, but, like, I think it's a rough thing to spin. And, like, maybe that works for, like, one god, right? Like, I think this is, I think, one of the fundamental problems with divine magic is that, like, you kind of implicitly... Because, like, one of the threats is that the god can take it away, right? Like, you know, if you don't adhere, you kind of implicitly always have the stamp of approval on your actions if you're being blessed with the power each
day. And that stamp of approval translates in practice to ideology, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for instance, you could say, if I were to take a cross-section of every cleric of a god and you know, map out the different domains, you're actually constructing an ideology that way. Because if you have a cleric and their ideology and their cleric and their domains are whatever, war, you know, like war, warder, you know, whatever, like you are crafting an ideology that is conquest and civilization oriented, sure, rather than nature oriented. Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I don't, this is not to say that I don't think your idea works. I think it does work in certain circumstances. It's just kind of like, you know, you'd say that, like, the God of Order probably doesn't have that many, you know, clerics of trickery, right? There's probably, like, one or two of them, right? And it's a very specialized kind of thing, right? Like,
And you would have to frame it in that way, right? That way of, like, I'm using the tools of the thing we oppose in order to oppose the thing we oppose. Ideologically, that person is still oriented towards order, Right. Or so, for instance, you know, so there's the fire god Zakesh. Part of the fire god's thing is that he's the god of war, but he's also the god of, like, civilization. But he's also the god of, like, frontiersmanship, right? And so you would have rangers of Zakesh who are learning about animals and trees and all this other sort of shit. But what they are doing is they are sort of opposing the power. They are mastering and harnessing sort of these aren't clerics, obviously, but they are mastering and harnessing, like, the powers of nature in order to civilize wilderness.
In order, right? To subjugate the wilds, yeah.
Yes, exactly, right? And that would have to be the approach. That's based off of a character I played who was exactly that kind of ranger, right? Who, you know, he was like a woodsman. He was like a wilderness guy or whatever. But his whole thing was that he wanted to protect people on the frontier from the dangers of the wild. So, yeah.
Now, you've given me an interesting thing to think about. It's like, if I could design a system that, like, would allow for divine magic and allow for, like, internecine conflict in a way that, like, wouldn't, like... I mean, I guess Luke brings up an interesting point, which is, like, the claim always has to be that, like, one side is false, and so you actually literally have to make one side false if you're going to make that work. Right? Like, either deceived or something else.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in a world where the gods are, like, in my head... You know, even clerics of a god are still receiving, like, portents and omens from that god, right? They're still receiving whatever, dreams or something. They can use, because there's, like, some divine magic that is, like, divination or whatever, where you can communicate with your god. Like, you have to have that stuff, sort of, in order to be able to support, you know, whatever, in order to be able to support this framework. And you'd have to really figure out how to deal with some of that stuff, especially if things are diametrically opposed. You know, if you have a group of, if you have one denomination that believes the exact opposite of another denomination, you know?
Yeah. That or like the gods just have to, like, work in, like, a fundamentally different way than people assume they do, right? Like,
you know. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of my own thing, which I to my recollection, you didn't enjoy, which was the idea that divine magic comes from the raw power of belief and faith, right? Without necessarily being granted specifically by a god, right? But that has this sort of carry on tag effect of, like, well, what are you saying? Like, I can't play a rogue who is a devout follower of the god of shadows. because their belief, you know, even if they dedicate the entirety of their character to this god or whatever, they don't have access to magic because they don't believe as hard as a cleric. That seems a little weird.
Yeah. It's the, like, you could do a thing like a Priest of Razmir type thing where, like, you know, it's actually, you're actually learning arcane magic, but you think it's divine magic or something, or, like, you know, like, you could do it in such a way that divine magic is, like, a form of studied something, and that explains why, like, your normal devout follower doesn't have access to it, but, like...
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's funny. I think of divine magic as institutional. I think of divine magic and arcane magic as being mostly institutional, right? You know, you learn, you sit down as a scholar and learn these... You know, like, kind of like these magics, these spells, these prayers or whatever. And I think of kind of martial and primal sort of power sources as being the opposite. It's being sort of intuitive, right? You know, this is another piece that of the campaign. The idea is that in, like, the ancient times, most people didn't worship gods; they worshipped sort of a diffuse shamanism, right?
Yeah.
but because you can't really teach primal magic to one another, like, you know, primal magic is an instinctive thing that you just sort of, like, have to sort of, like, feel. And this is a time before literacy and writing stuff down. You know, once a divine god came through and sort of scooped all of the worships out of a shamanistic society out from under itself, right? That's all of a sudden that primal magic kind of died for however many thousands of years until kind of the present day. Because, you know, the power of that sort of level of institution is something that drives, you know, whatever, drives out this sort of diffuse, abstract, right, strength that comes from nature, or essentially.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I just like it's all interpretation problems, and like the god is trying to tell you the right thing, but like they're just so powerful that actually putting direct knowledge in their brain would literally blow their fucking mind. Yeah, I guess that's probably true, right? Like one of the things that I dislike is I also dislike gods that manifest on the mortal plane, right? You know, like the idea has to be that if a god wants to influence the mortal plane, they can manifest a prophet. Right. You know, they can infuse someone with like their divine power and some level of an extension of their divine will. Same thing with clerics or, you know, paladins or sort of whatever else. But they themselves cannot cross over. Right. You could not have a god that exists on the mortal plane. That feels like an important piece of, I don't know. That's like very true of Forgotten Realms. And I've always hated that, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it can work if it's like very limited and like very short, right? And like the, you know, there are like rules. It's like, you know, I can only like project myself out here for like, you know, a day or whatever, right? Because of like the rules that govern. Like, I think that's the biggest problem with it, right? Is if you allow them to like be on the plane, you have to have like a reason why they don't do that shit all the time, right? Like, you know. Like, there's a pact that they're all bound to that is, like, some power greater than them that's, like, holding them to it.
Yeah, that is one other thing that I have added to this game. There's actually technically 9 gods. This is actually a thing that I'm sort of aping from WoW lore in a weird way. There's technically 9 gods. There are these 8 gods or whatever, but then there is a 9th god that is understood to exist by implication rather than any explicit confirmation, right? In the same way that you could intuit that a black hole exists by seeing things orbit it without being able to perceive the black hole directly. This is Cronox, the god of fate, who is, you know, they're so powerful and they are so powerful and they are above all of the other gods, but they don't empower clerics, they don't empower prophets, they don't empower paladins, right? And if there ever was, you know, like if Cronox ever did like send a prophet, that would be like huge. That would be like a you know, a completely different sort of thing. And to be honest with you, like until I play a prophet of Cronox, because I'm the specialist boy of all time, because the thing that I like is I like the idea of mysteries like that existing inside of a campaign setting that people can, you know, like figure out, right? Like, what have the lizard been up to? What are they doing? I know the answer to that question, right? But the point is that unless you're doing a campaign that's specifically about going into the heart of the jungle to decipher, you know, whatever it is the lizard men are sort of like planning and how their whole society works, right? They are just weird crocodile people doing freaky shit in their jungle and we don't understand it, right?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes total sense. Do you want to talk about anything else in your fun campaign setting?
I don't know. I guess I will offer questions to the chat. If you guys have any questions, I can answer them. But we can otherwise just, we're like 15 minutes over anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
The true gods were the friends we made along the way. True. I don't, there is a god, I think, because I tried to assign gods to each domain as like a specific sort of thing, right? So like, I think the goddess of wind is like also the goddess of community, right? And I just love the idea of the goddess of friendship. Okay.
Yeah. What do I have to say? I think that like, I think there's also a thing to be said for, like, leaving large chunks unwritten, right? And just kind of like, yeah, this, we'll fill things in depending on the way things go, right? Like, you know, This would be neat. Yeah.
Yeah, the funny thing is that we're not actually going to be playing in the Empire because I gave them a million pitches. And the pitch that ended up winning was 7th Expedition. You know, this thing that the fantasy Lewis and Clark that I pitched maybe like 6 years ago, a long time ago, I did a campaign pitch me on the idea of Seventh Expedition. But you know, the core conceit of that is that there is a new world that's been discovered and they're trying to map it out, and the previous 6 expeditions none of them have ever come back, and you guys are the 7th, right? And I have had this idea in the back of my mind for the longest time, but obviously that doesn't deal with any of this Empire shit. You're across the ocean, right?
Like, how many doom boats are there gonna be?
That's a good question. Yeah. Well, because the lore is that, you know, you could never sail here because there's a period of dead wind in the middle of the sea, right? Where if you just tried to sail, you'd never get past it. But because you have arcane crystals, you can now just make a ship that just goes, right? In the same way that you have like a steamship or something like that, like a coal-powered sort of like ship. And so that's exactly what happens. And they eventually, you know, there is a little civilization. There's an island off the coast called like White Harbor or something like that, right? You know, which has been sort of like colonized. And there's a little trading port there, but it's sort of the equivalent of like, I don't even know what I would call it, right? Like, I don't even know like a good historical example of something like this, like maybe Jamestown,
yes,
right? But like not even Jamestown really, or like the Massachusetts, you know, the Massachusetts, colonies from the 1600s. It's just sort of the first foothold and it's a little bit offshore, but you actually have to go on shore in order to whatever, like investigate stuff. And so, you know, they're obviously bringing with them a bunch of whatever politics and everything else, and some of that stuff will matter in White Harbor, but otherwise Seventh Expedition is all about finding out all the new crazy shit. I'm excited to eat my own boots the first winter. Listen, yay, it worked for the guys in the Terror, okay? Let me tell you.
Yeah, you gotta find the Northwest Passage.
They all died. I did describe it as the North. Hold on, what did I say? Think the Terror meets Roanoke meets Lewis and Clark meets Hearts of Darkness. Heart meets Heart of Darkness. That was, for all of these, I just sort of outlined a couple of like pop culture things. Like there's the one about going to the Lizardmen. It was think Indiana Jones meets Jurassic Park meets Atlantis, the Lost Empire. But yeah, Seventh Expedition definitely has a lot of boots eating.
Mm. Delicious boots. Is that where you're going to find the race of sentient pandas?
Oh my God. Maybe. I actually know how, like, the, you know, what people exist on the continent already and what they're, like, up to. All that stuff already exists.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
The thing I need to do now is make a map. Because the whole purpose of this is making a big, giant grid map and letting people just sort of sandbox their way through the map and, like, actually kind of uncover hex by hex each, you know, each kind of, like, interlocking, I guess, detail. But that's obviously going to take however much time.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. What else have you been up to this week?
That's a good question. I've been playing Helldivers. That's mostly
defending democracy.
I have been defending democracy. I have defended democracy so much. We've actually gotten to the point where we are regularly full clearing suicidal level 7 missions.
Nice.
Which feels great. We had this like, the thing about it that was really fun is, you know, we kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. There's a certain level of solo play versus group play, right? Where it's like, okay, everybody's going to spread out a little bit as we move towards the next big objective. And like, oh, one person's going to go clear an outpost and pick up the samples. Okay, great. One person's going to go, you know, get this minor point of interest. Okay, great. One person's going to go like solo a bonus objective. That's fine, right? But then like when, you know, we like need to come together or like reinforce one another's position, that's like a thing that we're doing. And then also it's like people have different roles in the party, right? So Rachel is almost always sneaking off to go find the super samples as like a core thing, right? Whereas me and Lou are doing sort of the main mission objectives, and then Mard is clearing outposts. Lou's job is to set down turrets, then kite while everything else kills everything. It works well for me. Yeah, you know, fair enough. I honestly sort of wonder, like, are we going one step higher? I don't even have anything. I have all the stratagems. I bought all the stratagems. I have $50,000 and I don't have anything to spend it on anymore. The only thing that matters in terms of like progression are the samples. And honestly, the super samples matter less than the common samples at this point. Like if I were to just go farm like 25 common samples in like a hard map, it would probably be more efficient than doing these suicidal missions. But you know, whatever, that's not fun.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally feel that. I have fallen off of the Helldivers a bit. I am very much looking forward. Stop that. Collins is rubbing his face against the green screen. I'm just watching it move behind me. No, what? No. Okay, he does not want to say hi. Dragon's Dogma comes out on Thursday, technically, I think Wednesday night in the Eastern time zone. I'm very much looking forward to that. I picked up some
Cyber... Right before...
PAX.
Right before PAX, yeah.
Yeah, this is actually why I'm going to PAX on Thursday morning instead of. I mean, there's other reasons too, but if I parked at my girlfriend's place on Wednesday, I would have to move it at 5 a.m. because of street cleaning, and so I'm not doing that. But
okay, pitch me on Dragon's Dogma. I've been hearing about it, and I guess I understand it to be Capcom Skyrim, right?
Imagine Skyrim plus the. I'll do your pop culture. Thing. Skyrim plus Monster Hunter plus Devil May Cry is the picture. Like, essentially the thing is that the combat is like actiony, and it's not the most RPG like focus necessarily, but the combat's really cool and engaging and active, and that's the thing that I'm looking forward to. Also, there's some like cool ideas, right? Like one of the advanced classes is the Arcane Trickster, and you can like make like smoke dummies that people that like your enemies will attack, and like you can put like a smoke clone of yourself on a smoke platform, and then an enemy will try and go attack it and like fall off a cliff because like they literally Wile E. Coyote themselves off the cliff, which is
wow.
But that's, you know, and that's one class. There's like the Mystic Spear Hand is kind of like a Jedi almost. It's got like, you know, like telekinesis and like like 4C looking stuff and like a dual handed sword. You can switch between these classes as yourself. It's all single player. You get a pawn, which is an AI companion, and then you can hire other pawns, which can be like, which are made like the pawns you hire are other people's pawns that they have put up to like go to go help other people. If you don't have an internet connection, you get stock ones. But and then what was the other thing? Oh, it's also supposed to be like insanely kind of like unforgiving, but in like a fun way. Like, you know, like you will miss things because you will, right? Like, you know, it's one of those things where it's like it is nearly impossible to like hit every corner. And like, you know, if one of the examples they gave is like if an NPC dies, they'll go to the morgue and then eventually, and like you can revive them with like the, you know, the resurrection item if you go there, but eventually they'll be buried. And once they're buried, they're gone. They're gone forever. Right, so it looks neat. The first game I dabbled in. Essentially it got to a point where it was a very rough game, widely, you know, acknowledged it needed a bit more time to polish. Essentially this game is Dragon's Dogma 2 is like the first game, a lot of ways, the first game again, but with the time it needed to like fully bake, and so, you know, I've seen a lot of excitement for it. Interestingly, they're like, so part of the thing they're doing for promotion is like, pawns, sponsored by famous Twitch streamers or whatever, right? And so one of the guys that I follow, Willie Versus, is doing it. It's also got like Asmongold to Sphere Hunter, which is like opposite ends of this of the spectrum, right? Like. Asmongold is okay. Like the shithead, and Sphere Hunter's like a, you know, like a trans creator that's like, you know, very much kind of like an opposite corner. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. And then I've been playing a bunch of Street Fighter. I dropped rank because last Friday, I want to say, I just like was like, I started playing and I like went on full tilt and I didn't let myself stop it. And things went poorly for me. But
I'm sorry to hear that, buddy.
Yeah, I didn't drop a full categorization. I just dropped from like plat 4 to plat 3. The grinding all day. You know, I'm always on the grind to get my ranks. What else? Like I was telling you before we got on the cast, I'm putting together some magic decks for packs. I'm playing in my works. Markov Manor Sealed League. I have lost a bunch, but I forget the name of the card, but I got this very nice card that I built my deck around. It's one green, one white, and then one green or white. It's a 4/4, and it's got three activated abilities. One green, one any is grant creature death touch. One white, grant creature vigilance. One white, two colorless, grant creature double strike. And it's just like such a good card. It's such a good card that it immediately gets targeted by removal as soon as it comes out on the field. But
sure. Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't send in combat as long as you have bumped mana for it, right?
Yeah, yeah. It is a very powerful bomb, right? Like, even just like this, you know, 4-4 for 3 is just, like, pretty great.
Yeah, a 4-4 for 3 that can give itself double strike.
Yeah.
And vigilance is actually kind of insane. Like, double strike, vigilance, and, like, man, just, like, walking into any fight with 5 mana open that you could, like, give it all 3 if you wanted is, like, that is pretty brutal.
Yeah.
What an interestingly designed card. Because normally I think of those effects as being very inefficient and bad, right? You don't want to be spending your mana on temporary combat modifiers, right? But it just happens to be such a good collection of combat modifiers, I guess.
Yeah, and it's yeah. it's also for, like, for a sealed game where, like, you know, basically you have the opportunity to, like, swing on face a bunch of times. And you want to use that when you can, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to have stuff to do, right?
Like, yeah. Yeah, I guess the Sealed League is obviously very different than something else.
Yeah, like in a constructed format, yeah.
Who is, like, managing this thing at your work? Like, organizing it, I guess.
One of my coworkers, he organizes them every expansion. Basically sends out an email, the whole office, anybody in the office who's interested, like, you know, gives them $20, he gives them 6 packs, I think. Then we play against each other, round robin style.
Yeah, so the thing I've always wanted to do is sort of a sealed commander league. I've heard about these. I've always wanted to do one, which is that you designate a set of commander decks, right? Like a set of the commander decks that comes out. People get, you know, whatever deck they want, right? And then every expansion, you can buy a certain number of packs, like 3 packs or something, and you can only add the things from those packs to your commander decks, right? And so it has this sort of, like, effect of keeping... you know, just kind of keeping a ceiling on sort of, like, power level and stuff. But you could also do, like, really interesting things where, like, you know, you can imagine a version of this where this goes 2 years or something, right? That's 10 expansions because Magic is fucking insane,
yeah.
Right? That's 10 expansions, 30 packs. You could almost rewrite your entire commander deck, right? If you wanted to pull with colors. Some of those. Yeah. Yeah, that's the other thing, is that you would also have to, like, make sure you're sort of, like, lucky with colors and trying your best. I feel like the best way to do this is maybe I would say, like... I don't know what I would say. Or I don't know how I would want to approach that. But
I saw in PAX there's, like, a commander draft. I don't know how. Like, I think there's, like, specific commander draft boosters, but that seems like an interesting thing to do. I don't know, like, how it works. Like, I guess they have to, like, guarantee you a legendary creature at some point. But
yeah, I mean, do you know about cubes? Have you ever done
a
cube?
Yeah, draft? but a cube is like assembled, right? Like, you know, it's
yeah. I suppose that's true.
Right.
I mean, there was a commander set that was built to be draftable.
I think it's Baldur's Gate.
Commander Legends or something? Or was it Baldur's Gate?
Oh, well, wow. So the one at PAX is a Baldur's Gate commander.
Oh, okay.
A commander draft.
Yeah, I do know that there is a commander set that is built to be draftable. That was, like, one of the selling points of it, but I never actually participated in those drafts. Because one of the things is that the boosters had more. I'm pretty sure the boosters were 20 cards each, and... were 20 cards each or something, and you did 6 of them or something, like 6 rounds of drafts. Maybe it was 30 cards, you did 4 rounds.
Sure.
It was like some weird number of rounds, obviously.
I'd be interested in trying some sort of sealed format for Commander, just to see what it was like.
I love different. I love like fucked up Magic format. Like Star is obviously. I always pitch that we play Star because I think it's such a great format for, like, a multiplayer game. Right?
Yeah, I mean, if this forgetful fish deck comes in, I'll make sure to play a game with you at some point.
Yeah, for real. I haven't looked. You sent it to me, and then I didn't ever actually looked up, like, the rules for it or whatever.
It's. I mean, it plays by standard Magic rules, but it's like the forgetful fish is the Dandan, and the Dandan's a 4/1 creature that if you ever stop controlling an island. You have to sacrifice it. And so there's, like, a lot of kind of, like, turn all lands into mountains types effects, right? Like, dumb stuff like that, and, like, counter spells. And, like, it's a shared graveyard and a shared deck. So, like, you putting things back on top of the deck to, like, force your opponent to draw, like, a thing that isn't very useful to them, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, it used to, like, I think I mentioned this last time. It used to be a super cheap deck. Because no one wanted any of those fucking cards. And now it's a popular format, so the deck's like $250. I bought a proxy off of Etsy for like $43. But, like, you know, and, like, I looked into it myself, and that, like, I think essentially someone did a group buy on, like, one of these custom MTG card sites and, like, put out, like, you know, tried to do a group buy for it. But, like, you know, there's just, like, it takes you can get a better rate on the cards, but just like at the size, the deck's 80 cards, so like it's like $80 for the deck, right? So
can't attack unless defending player controls an island. When you control no islands, sacrifice Dan Dan. Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, yeah. You know, fuck yeah, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I honestly haven't been doing anything all that much. I've been playing some Ever After Falls, right? One of our sort of internal games. I keep making eyes at Hearts of Iron. I am so intimidated by Hearts of Iron. I don't know that I've ever been intimidated by a game to the extent that I have been intimidated by Hearts of Iron. And I know I would have fun if I just sat down and played it. And I played a game as Italy to, like, remake the Roman Empire or whatever, you know, do this alternate history bullshit that, like, the game is kind of, like, known for. But for some reason, I'm just so spooked by, like, the level of systems mastery that I just keep watching YouTube videos about it and never actually playing Hearts of Iron.
Hey, you know, whatever makes you happy, man.
They added a subscription service to get all of the DLC, and that's the other thing, is that I don't want to, like, buy into the subscription service because I feel like I would need all the DLC in order to have fun.
Well, I mean, if you wanted to just try it, like, buying a 1 month subscription seems like a better way to do it than, like, you know, buying all of it forever.
That's probably true, right? Like, $8 to just, like, get 1 month of, you know, whatever fun.
Yeah. Play it till it's out of your system, then drop off.
Yeah.
Well, do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, I am good.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up then. If you like to email us about anything we talk about on the show, you can email us at SpiritsFullGames@gmail.com or podcast@SpiritsFullGames.com. You can follow us at twitch.tv/SpiritsFullGames or youtube.com/SpiritsFullGames. All the links are down in the description. Rate, review us wherever you find podcasts. That's everything I have. Buddy, do you have anything else you're looking to promote?
I do have one thing I'm looking to promote. We talked about it a little bit. I'm going to be at PAX East this year. We're doing PAX East. We're showing off a bunch of cool games, okay? We're bringing cool games to PAX East, and that's it. That's the story. Okay?
Yeah, if you're going to be at the PAX East booth, visit the Acapara booth, or PAX East.
Yeah, 15091 is the booth. That's it.
I will be there as well, not at the booth necessarily, although there's a decent chance you'll see me there, because if it's anything like last year, every time I walk past the booth, I'll, like, go and, like, give Betty a high five or something.
True.
But if you...
I don't know if we're a central. We were really central last year. I don't know if we're going to be a central this year, but who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, I'm going to say until next time, dear listeners.
Until next time, loyal listeners.